Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to have here on the program this morning Richard Herman. He is the chancellor of the University of Illinois here at Urbana-Champaign. And for those of you who do not live your lives inside the academic world, that means, in effect, he is the CEO of this campus. He is the top guy here in Urbana-Champaign. He has been here at the University of Illinois since 1998. Has served as provost and also vice chancellor for academic affairs, and has been involved in higher education administration for about 20 years, in round figures. Before coming here to Illinois, he served as dean of the College of Computer, Mathematical, and Physical Sciences at University of Maryland, College Park, where he got his PhD in math. He also was chair of the Department of Mathematics at Penn State from 1986 until 1990. I have a list of things to ask him about, but the idea here is that also people who are listening, people who are here in the university community, can call in with questions about whatever issues concern them. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, that's the number. And we do also have a toll-free line, and of course anybody can join the conversation. If it would be a long-distance call, use that number, 800-222-9455. And here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-455. Thank you very much for being here.
Well, good morning, David. It's a pleasure to be here as always. I hope many of your listeners manage to see the graduation. Our speaker was Javed Karim, one of our students, who was one of the three people who put together YouTube.
Shows you can graduate from the University of Illinois and then go on to make something of yourself.
Just that. Well, we have many success stories, and I think he connected in wonderful ways with our students, of course, having been one only 3 or 4 years ago.
Well, that's one of the things that he said something to the effect of, you know, there may be people who have stood there giving that speech before who have been more prestigious or older or seen more of the world or been out of college for a longer time, and that it was his hope that maybe that indeed he could say something that students would be able to relate to because they were essentially of the same age and the same generation.
Right. I mean, I think the story of the transition into the workplace, the idea that he was willing to take risks and that this was a place that supported that kind of activity, I think is a great story.
Yeah. And go ahead. Well, I just one of the things that I thought I wanted to ask you is a sort of a general, very general kind of question is to think about how things in higher education have changed over the time that you've been an administrator. And going back to the time where I suppose you can count the time as being the department chair, as being an administrator. So we're looking at about 20 years. How much or what are the most important things that have changed, do you think, over that time?
Well, one, I've been had the good fortune to be at public universities all of my academic career, except for the very, very start when I was at Rochester. I think there's a special place in this world for public higher education. First, we educate about 85% of those students who go on to higher ed, and here I count community colleges as well. But I think it comes to the issue of paying attention to the social good. Mm-hmm. And I think that's becoming more and more prominent as we go, certainly during my administrative career. So, for instance, I am very fond of this energy endeavor that we engaged with BP and University of California, Berkeley. We're addressing the problems of the larger society. But that has a consequence for the sort of question you asked, where I think we are more and more focusing on interdisciplinary activities. So, for instance, just on our end of the world, we have folks from the College of ACES involved, the agricultural arm, as it were, the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, the College of Engineering, and the College of Law involved in just our part of that Energy Biosciences Institute. And the other point being, which I've made elsewhere, all the talent wasn't even here or at Berkeley. So these two great public institutions, which go head-to-head with each other, combined in wonderful ways, combined their expertise to address this important problem. It's important to me that this, I think it's important to the nation that the award went to public institutions. Mm-hmm. This is what we do.
So more cooperation across disciplines, and you think there will be in the future there'll be more cooperation between institutions that previously would have been competing I suppose they still are competing for money.
We are. We'll you know, one day we're working with each other, and the next day we're competing. But there's another piece, I think, where students are now coming to us with so many different interests. Not even one third of our students, it's roughly 30%, stay with their original major. And I think that is one of the glories about an institution like ours that has comprehensive excellence, because if you decide to change your mind, if you're enticed to go in another direction, then you'll find excellence there. It's not like we're a school known for just this or that. Yeah. So we have excellence in music, and we have excellence in the arts more broadly, excellence in the humanities, excellence in the sciences and technology.
Certainly one thing that has happened over all these years is that the cost of college education has continued to go up. And think that we should expect that that's going to continue. The problem, and I think a lot of people point to, is that the kinds of increases in costs that we have seen, they just seem not to be sustainable. And certainly there continue to be people who find ways to go to college and to send their kids to college. And I suppose that one way that a lot of people have to do that now is they have to borrow money. So they end up finishing up with big debts. Right. So people can still go, but I think that a lot of folks ask this question, at what point does it get to the point where something's got to give? We can't continue to increase tuition and simply expect students and their families to somehow, somewhere, find the money so they can pay the bills.
I think you're correct, and our goal ultimately is, one of our important goals is accessibility, and that includes across the entire socioeconomic spectrum. And so far, we've been able to do this quite well. We look in terms of, despite the increases in tuition over the past 5 or 6 years, economically, our students look pretty much like they did 6 years ago. And the increase in debt has been less than the cost of living increase over those 6 years, whereas tuition has gone up, as you know, a lot more than that in terms of percentages. So we've been fortunate enough to be able to redirect some of our own monies, and most fortunate to have the great support of friends of this institution and alumni. Alumni from all many disciplines who are providing scholarships and fellowships so that our students can come here. And that is, in fact, going to be a major focus of our upcoming campaign as we go down the road. And, you know, the state has a very good assistance program, and the federal government, sort of at the low end of the spectrum, is finally coming around to increasing the Pell Grants, which is long overdue.
Do you think that it's going to continue to be that is... The fact that one of the things that we've seen is that over time that the amount of money that the state of Illinois directly contributes to higher education has declined. Is that something that you think that that's simply going to be a fact of life? It's going to continue in the future?
Well, I actually think that you're correct in that this has happened. There have been moments in time when the state has contributed more. Increased significantly, and certainly in my lifetime here. 5 years ago, we got enormous increases as we focused on economic development. My hope is that the state will continue to look for ways to support us. But it is simply the case that the social burdens on the state now are enormous all across the country. And, frankly, the ability of any state to contribute is also a function of the economy of that state. So it's going to be geographically different, but generally there's a large social burden.
Well, I'm sure that part of your job and part of the job of the president and the other chancellors is to talk to people to encourage them to support the university.
Yes.
And certainly among the people that you talk to are legislators.
Correct.
I figure that you don't have to sell them on the idea that strong institutions like the university are important to the economy of the state. Right. Is it the case that they would say to you, look, I understand that. You don't have to persuade me of that. I would like to see the University of Illinois get more money, but we're simply giving you, we're giving the university as much as we can. Is that what people say to you?
Sometimes. I mean, they will also say that they are, some will say they're supportive of much larger increases. Mm-hmm. Some will say, you know, we're supportive of an increase and this is all we can get done this year. So there is a reality. I think one of the good things that's come out of our planning is that we're hoping to really create a picture for 5 years down the road so we can be talking to the state, not just in an incremental fashion. Hmm. But you know, in a long-term way. And I think ultimately, as I've said elsewhere, the fate, if you will, even if just the economic fate of most states are heavily linked to the universities. Certainly in the 90s, that was quite evident as states succeeded. Their economic fate was linked to the innovation that was coming out of universities. And ultimately, look, our best technology transfer or knowledge transfer is our students, our graduates. Mm-hmm. And I know in the college, the engineering graduates on whom we have the best data stay in the state for between 5 and 10 years at the level of about 55%. So they are contributing directly to the economy of the state.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Richard Herman. He is the chancellor of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And whatever questions people listening have, you can pick up the phone and call 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I think for some time now, on the level of primary secondary education, one of the big buzzwords has been accountability. Mm-hmm. That is, people say things like, well, I believe in the institution of the public schools, and I'm okay with the idea of my tax dollars going to support the school. However, what I'm expecting is for them to demonstrate that they're doing something important with the money. And for that reason, just about everybody has instituted testing, at least, so that there can be some sort of figures on paper of student performance that schools can show. They say, here, okay, here's how our students are doing. Here's how they did last year. They can show trends, and then you can make some comparisons between various kinds of students and so forth. There are some people who think that universities should be required to do that very thing as well, that perhaps before a person graduates, they should have to take a test to show what they've learned and to show what they've gotten for their money, and so that universities can demonstrate that they're educating their students. I think that universities to date have said, look, the students are grown-ups. It's up to them to get out of their education what they're going to get, and it's we put the education out there, and they take it or they not. And we're not going to get into that kind of business. What do you think about that idea that some people would say, well, you, that the university and that all universities should have some better way of demonstrating student performance so that then the taxpayers of the state of Illinois can have some kind of assurance that they're actually getting something for their money?
Well, one, there are several questions, several statements you made as well. I would take issue with the premise as you began that we just offer education and it's up to the students to take it because, well, that may have been the case at one point in university, I don't mean this one in particular, history. Mm-hmm. There was a time certainly when I started school, I remember one teacher saying to me, well, look to your left and look to your right, and one of these individuals will not be here when graduation comes about. I think that attitude has changed markedly, significantly in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And I think we've become less the pedagogy has gone from sage on the stage to guide on the side. There's much more involvement, much more understanding of how individuals learn. And that's greatly affected the pedagogy. It's affected the classroom in terms of, how teaching assistants interact, how faculty interact with individuals. So that's one premise I'd like to at least say I don't agree with. Mm-hmm. But there is a move afoot, and I think that's coming at the national level from Margaret Spellings, where She and others would like to essentially federalize accreditation as a vehicle for establishing just the set of goals which you've articulated, namely test in and test out. And honestly, if I look at the universities that I know, I think we're very happy to be judged by the success of our graduates when they leave our institutions. You know, having a test, a little snapshot in time, to me is not the way to judge. I mean, we do give grades. Yes, I understand grade inflation. We don't seem to be suffering from that overly. But we also know, perhaps the best example is coming in. We know the ACT plays one role for us, or SAT on the East Coast. The grade point average, the essays, no single issue is determinative. We do full file reviews for the most part. You know, obviously, you have a high enough grade point average, a high enough ACT, you'll be admitted without too much of a closer look. But we actually, for those who don't fulfill that, we look very closely at their files. Mm-hmm. So I think this snapshot issue is facile, and I think it is definitely the wrong way to go. And I'm aware of the accreditation discussions going on in Washington today, and I think they are, at least those ideas coming out of the Department of Education, are misguided.
Where do you think that comes from? Do you think that there is some sort of innate hostility toward higher education?
No. I mean, I think there are data which suggests something's amiss. In the end, only 30% of the students who leave high school graduate with a bachelor's degree. And I think we do need to worry about that. But I don't think, and it is a serious problem, the number of students going into science and technology have been on the wane for a decade. So I think there are real issues, but they don't lend themselves to easy solutions.
Yeah. I don't really think that I was meaning to suggest that the university, once a student entered, didn't care whether the student graduated or not. Right. I guess I'm thinking more about the idea that the idea is that it's up to the student to make the most of the experience, and that there is, and maybe this is something that has changed, that there is such a thing as a right to fail, and that we're going to do as much as we can to help you make the most of that experience, but that a point comes when we simply have to say, look, it's up to you.
Right. Now, I think that's fair. There's a lot of individual drive that goes into success in any endeavor in life, including right here at the university. But there's an ancillary point that I would like to make here, which is that, you know, students also learn from each other. And that's why we don't tell the story, look to your right and left, and one person won't be here. Look to your right and left, and this person has something to tell you. So listen carefully.
Mm. We have a caller. We'd certainly welcome others. We're getting close to midpoint here. Our guest is Richard Herman. He is the chancellor of the U of I here in Urbana-Champaign. And if you have questions about life in the university community, university policy, where the university is headed, any and all of that, I'm sure he'd be happy to get your question. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have a caller here in Urbana, line number one.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have a question about graduate students in the disciplines like history or English or perhaps political science, where possibilities of employment with higher degrees are probably not increased. In other words, if people are looking for academic careers, they're facing a competition with maybe 500 people applying for a job, and what I'm wondering is, do the graduate students prior to entering get any kind of counseling about job opportunities, or do they just go in with the dream of, oh, I love this field, and I know I'll be so good at it that that I'll get the one job?
That is a very interesting and important question. First, I would say it's important to have the dream. It's important to be passionate about your subject, your field of endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
But honestly, I don't believe that most of our disciplines are saying, when you graduate here, we want you to become a professor. Obviously, that is one route. But if you look at what's happened over time, many individuals, I would say, if I look at my own field of mathematics, many individuals have not gone into the professoriate. They've gone elsewhere and been enormously successful in the world of business or corporations. And I think the same is true for political scientists and historians that leave our institution and other institutions. They go out into the world and contribute to society.
Oh, okay. So they're not.
But you're right. You're right about the academic
jobs. They're not limiting their job options innocently.
No, we try to be as clear as we can about job possibilities. Sometimes you'll see people get caught in the system where all of a sudden the job market will collapse. Other than those happenstances, we're pretty good at communicating to folks.
Oh, that's good to hear.
Thank you for the question.
Thanks.
Oh, thanks. I have here had on the program over the last few years of some conversations with people from the graduate college and people who have done some research looking at questions like who goes for PhDs and why is it that people start and they don't get all the way through and those sorts of things. And it seems as if graduate colleges are trying to spend more time talking with people about career possibilities and making sure that people understand that there are other possibilities other than going and having a career in higher education with a PhD. That's not the only option that's open to people.
Right. Exactly, David. And one of the things, if you look at the data that we have, you'll see a large number of what we would call professional master's degrees being offered. I think that this is a good thing. When I went to school, the master's degree often was thought of as a, quote, consolation prize for those who didn't finish their PhD. I think that's changed significantly, and there's a large national movement among all graduate schools to come up with just my end of the world professional science masters.
Well, again, we're here at our midpoint here. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let me ask you about another subject, and that has to do with campus security. Mm. In the wake of the tragedy at Virginia Tech, I know that a lot of places, I'm sure everybody's thinking about then looking at their security plans. One of the issues there, and I'm sure, again, on other campuses, is if there is some sort of emergency, how do we communicate that to staff? And I know here at the university you're looking at instituting a system that would do that. What is it that you're expecting that you're going to do?
Well, we'll actually be able to just text message individuals directly from a central location, fundamentally.
And how that... I don't know how many cell phones there are in this campus and how many computer screens. I'm sure that there are a lot. How quickly do you anticipate that you would actually be able to get that accomplished and get the word?
Actually, I'd like to say I know the exact answer to that, but there are some limitations in terms of traffic. But I would think we could get the word out reasonably rapidly. I think the more serious question is what to say. I mean, if I think about that Virginia Tech instance, what is it you would have said? Stay where you are? Well, who would you have told to stay, and who would you have told to leave? Mm-hmm. So I think the complexity, these policy decisions are ones that need to be thought through. And I know we have an emergency management team for the entire area, And we've gone through exercises involving myself, the mayors of the cities, and other individual heads of the police forces and the fire departments. So we've actually done live exercises just to work through some of these things. Final analysis, you hope you have it right. I mean, because that was a dreadful circumstance.
What, I guess one of the things I find myself wondering is I imagine that there actually are people, and I'm one of them, who do not carry cell phones. There will be some people that you can't reach that way.
And hopefully the word will be able to reach enough so that we get the movement in the right direction. But we've actually thought about this for emergency purposes, even going back 4 or 5 years, just to be able to have a phone, which even a phone on which you could just call 911. And that's also been discussed.
Yeah. We have someone else to talk with. Let's do that. Champagne, line one. Hello.
Yeah, hello, Chancellor. I have an issue that really goes to my heart. I'm a minority, and I really sense from talking to minority faculty, staff, and especially students that they would consider or characterize the situation at the Urbana-Champaign campus as full of tension for them in terms of how they interact, how they are accepted, how they are marginalized because of their race or ethnicity, and this would be African-Americans and Latinos primarily. And a lot of this centers around Chief Alinowick and the debacle, in my estimation, that's surrounded his demise. I really believe, and this is in all due respect, that neither you nor President White embodied profiles and courage in the way you handle this, and I'd like for you to respond.
Well, I guess I'd have to understand the detail of the last statement, but generally, we this past year certainly had what I would describe as racist incidents, and we dealt with them in an open manner. Certainly, what I've spoken out off and on is the issue of where free speech ends and incivility begins. And just to go back to something that struck me in my childhood was I grew up with the phrase, sticks and stones will break my bones, but words will never harm me, which perhaps is some version of turn the other cheek. But at this point, I've come to disbelieve that statement, that words do harm, and we have to do a better job in creating common ground for the common good. I would say that over the years, I think many individuals have helped bring about progress on making this a better place for the Latino community, for the African American community. Are we where we need to be? I would say no. But if you look at the investments we've made in trying to increase the marginalized populations among the students, among the faculty and the staff. We have made significant ones. And that's also in terms of the programs we offer. We've actually seen a lot of progress. But again, we are not where we need to be. And I honestly believe that as we go into the coming year, you're going to see way that we're beginning to fashion to build on difficulties we've had this past year.
Well, I kept yearning and longing, maybe that's the term, for either you or President White to come out and not be so coy about where you stood on the chief issue and on all these other issues. I get the distinct impression that you were allowed to let a president Emil Jones, an African-American, a powerful African-American, and president of the board, Epley, take the heat while you two guys who make nice salaries and are supposed to be models in leadership sort of get by with under their cover. And that really disturbed me.
Well, I'm sorry you feel that way, but both the president and I work for the Board of Trustees. And rightly or wrongly, the board took the issue of the chief under advisement in 1992, I believe, and it's their decision to make. Did we have things to say to the board? Did they ask our thoughts, our guidance? Most certainly, but that is where the discussion needed to take place. But I would say, in that regard, I would say, judge me and the president by the things we have engendered, and I'd be happy to stand on my right on those things.
All right, thank you. Right.
Well, I don't want to keep talking about this forever, but because of the nature of your position, did you feel that for you to publicly make some sort of statement about your personal feeling one way or another would simply have been inappropriate?
Well, without the direct characterization, I think the answer is yes, for the following reasons. If there was going to be a change or just a declaration that we're going down the same road, in the end, I believed, although I couldn't be sure, that the resolution of that decision or what flowed from it would be left to me, in the sense that I would have to bring the parties together. And if I were to take a stand one way or the other, I am unable then to bring parties together. And you notice when I came out of the board meeting after they did, pass the resolution, the first word I said was healing. And I am focused on that because I think it is not a question of those who held the view of favoring the chief or those who held the view of getting rid of the chief. I see these people as having held their beliefs dearly, motivated by good purposes. And these are good people. But we need to function as a community, and healing is the goal.
Let me ask you just as a follow-up to the other comment that the caller made. What we have seen over the last few years on a number of college campuses, shocking examples of racial insensitivity by students.
Certainly.
The one recent one here and involves some students acting out racist, Latino racist stereotypes. Mm-hmm. One of the things that seems to shock a lot of us about it is that somehow the students don't seem to understand why that's a problem. When something like, and this was something that you yourself had to confront on this campus, and other administrators have had to confront other places, what do you do when something like that happens? Is it your impulse to say something to those students particularly? And I know that you have to say something to the university community as a whole. You must respond. You can't not do anything. But one really wonders what exactly someone in your position can do about that. What should the university do about that?
This is exactly the question, the struggle we have, because it goes back to the free speech comment. But honestly, you're right. I have to say something. Is it a teaching moment? Of course. Is there education about this? In the sense that, after all, these are young people who have gone this route, wrong though it may be. So is there a way to bring them to the idea that, in fact, it is wrong? And I can use the bully pulpit, and I have done that. But ultimately, that's insufficient. We all, I think the professors have to speak to this issue, the faculty and staff and other students have to really engage. And, in fact, that's what we're trying to get done. And then two are the issues of have their actions actually violated the student code, and how do we deal with that? And obviously, as you know, those issues went in front of the student, the Conduct Governance Committee. Yeah.
Well, let's talk with some other folks, at least one other caller here. We have about 15 minutes left in this, a little bit less in this part of Focus. Our guest is Richard Herman. He's chancellor of the U of I here in Urbana-Champaign. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number if you'd like to join the conversation. We have a couple of people here standing by, both in Urbana. First, line one.
Hello. Good morning.
Yes.
Good.
Go ahead. Yes, go ahead.
Okay. Maybe a little easier question on building maintenance on campus. The Beckman and the plaza, there's a fountain there just south of Beckman, and that's been dry for at least the past couple summers. I know about 2 years ago or 3 years ago they found a leak underneath it, and they were losing a lot of water, but it just seems a shame that in the summer that used to be a pretty vibrant place with people at lunchtime sitting around and the fountain's going, and now it just kind of collects trash and seems to be kind of a forlorn place. And I know that they've started assessing maintenance fee for to help with campus maintenance. So I just wondered if that's something that could be taken care of.
My hope, in fact, is that that does get done fairly quickly. Deferred maintenance has been a big issue for us, and I think you probably know there are many buildings in need of a lot of work. Regarding fountains, you perhaps noticed that the fountain just west of the Atlanta Union has now been restored to working.
Yes, that was another one that
all right.
I noticed.
So I think we, entire university system, have made an enormous commitment to address the deferred maintenance issues. And, well, you know, this is the thing you do one building at a time, one fountain at a time. But I couldn't be more sympathetic to your comment, and certainly never want to think of the campus as a forlorn place. Certainly, I had the good fortune to host 62 other universities of the American Association of Universities, and probably fully half of those presidents and chancellors walked up to me and said, what a beautiful campus you have. So I feel good about that, but I know it's going to take an enormous effort to keep it at a high level and then at the same time pay attention to the important things you bring up.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's go to another Urbana caller. This would be line number two in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to hear more about the university's agreement with BP. I haven't heard anything about the details, and all I know is what I've read in the California press. I know it's a controversial agreement in Berkeley. So some of the things I've read about it says that the plan allows BP to embed its employees on campus with our researchers. It allows BP to operate its own private commercial labs on campus. And it also allows BP to control research agenda. Let's see, one other thing I read was that it doesn't include peer review, and it gives BP broad commercial rights to co-own and license the academic inventions. Could you discuss that, please?
Sure. There was a lot of press in California. I'll try and remember all the points you made, but the structure. The reason you haven't heard much about it is that the after the initial agreement that Berkeley and we would be funded to carry out the research, that is the creating biofuels for the future. It now became an issue for the scientists to define the specifics of the problems, although we obviously put in front of BP a number of very, very good ideas, in fact, which allowed us to win. And so right now the scientists are working to see, well, what is the first, what are the first sets of problems that we wish to approach. So that's going to take place, and we've allocated space in our new Institute for Genomic Biology as well as a significant land space, which will grow the crop miscanthus, which is the basic well, which is much more efficient than corn stover in terms of creating biofuels. And having said that, the difficulties were those which, in fact, you pointed to. But the I don't know whether you read about the resolution at Berkeley, where it was ultimately decided, in fact, that the proper safeguards were, in fact, in place, as I believe they are here. Only here, I think it was a little more evident to people than it was at Berkeley. But in the end, Berkeley, the faculty as a whole, did affirm that this was a good thing. The specifics you spoke to, yes, we're delighted to have BP employees on campus working side by side with our scientists because they are helping give us new problems to work on, new ways in which our expertise might be brought to bear on problems of the larger society. There will be a portion of the work that is closed, that is intellectual property rights will flow to BP, and there'll be a portion of the work that's open. Fundamentally, this is significantly basic research, and I think BP in creating this opportunity, and I view it as just that, is showing corporate social responsibility at its highest. So I'm delighted to be part of it.
Well, in light of that, could you discuss your concerns then about this agreement as an example? The university, the public university, just becoming a profit-making subsidiary of large corporations?
I guess I don't believe your characterization at all. I see us, you know, if you look at the origins of this great land-grant institution, we were always meant to address the social good. And ultimately, whether we do that through our graduates going out into the world or addressing problems of society, I mean, and fundamentally, an awful lot of our work, whether it's in science and technology or in the School of Social Work, has to do with problems of society. So I don't see us as an arm of the corporation at all. I see this I see us and the private sector as part of an ecosystem to advance society.
Okay, well, thank you for answering my question.
All right, let's go to line number one. This is a caller in Champaign. Hello.
Hi, yes. I'm curious. This is kind of related to the previous caller. I'm curious how you would react to the characterization that fields such as some of the humanities or some of the social sciences, whether they be history or they be English or political science or whatever, that they don't actually speak to as much to that social good as you were just talking about science and technology speaking to, and therefore is that related to what seems to be a trend in higher education of cutting these particular departments or giving less money for TA-ships, for example, or changing graduate education in them because they do not interact as well in that particular ecosystem that you were describing?
Well, I thank you for the question. And that's always a troublesome point. It certainly was troublesome as we thought about economic development as part of the mission of the institution. Your average English professor will say when they're coming up for promotion, well, how do I enter economic development on my CV? How do I show what I've done? I think we were addressing that as an institution. But honestly, I don't buy the argument that the humanities and the arts don't contribute. I think they contribute in fundamental ways to human understanding. They help us tell our stories. Their approaches to issues of multiculturalism, which can only be done through the arts, through the humanities. They tell stories. Take the stories of the Holocaust. How do you explain the incomprehensible? How do you make it comprehensible? Look at the work of Elie Wiesel. Look at the work of our own Rick Powers in telling wonderful stories. I don't buy that the humanities and the social sciences are not contributors. I think they're enormous contributors to the social good. and certainly to helping shape our graduates.
Okay, thank you.
Because I'm sure that there are that people have asked this question about the future of the humanities. At least at big research universities like this. And they'd say, you know, you walk around the university, you can see where the money is. And it ain't in the humanities. And I suppose that some people might go as far as to say, well, do we really need to teach the classics? Really? Do we need a philosophy department? Now, I actually think we do. But there were people who would say, you know, those sorts of things, maybe they're just not relevant anymore. And we could do without them. And we could get rid of the classics department and we could have one more engineer.
I liked your ratio. That was an interesting comment about salaries. It's not quite that bad.
All right. We could have two engineers.
There were two engineers. But all kidding aside, I spoke earlier of what it takes to be a great institution, a great university. And I think the issue of comprehensive excellence and the... is one that must include the humanities. It must include the arts. And this says a lot about what we expect a student to encounter when they go forward. And it's not just... And I think there is a lot of wonderful work that is going on in all of those disciplines. And it's... I do understand the issue of where new facilities come from and so on and so forth. But, you know, I'm very happy that Lincoln Hall is the number one capital priority for the state. And it's there because the state was kind enough to put it there, but it wouldn't have put it there had we not put it there. Mm-hmm. So we're making quite a strong statement about the humanities.
We have a couple of minutes left. A lot of other things we could talk about. Let me ask one other. And again, it goes back to the Virginia Tech case. And I'm sure that, again, a lot of places around the country have thought about what their responsibility is towards students who may be having emotional difficulties. And particularly, how do you walk the line between your concerns about student welfare and also your obligation to respect privacy and autonomy in the student?
Yeah, I think we have to be quite vigilant. And there's this sort of issue of in loco parentis, which disappeared in the early 70s, and I'm very happy to see come back. It has to do with more obvious things like alcohol and drug abuse, where I think we have some wonderful programs. But I think asking our faculty and staff and fellow students to be attentive to what they think is aberrative. I mean, one faculty member told me recently of having a student in his office who sounded to him, quite depressed. He took the student in his car and rushed him to McKinley. So I think those sorts of, I'm not suggesting that those are the only actions, but we do need to be attentive. And honestly, I feel very good on a national scale about the kinds of student services we have here. We are often called out as having the best sort of counseling across the country.
Is it spelled out? Is it made clear as a matter of policy to faculty what is recommended for them to do in a situation like that? Or are they, in a sense, going on their own gut feeling about what it would be appropriate to do for a student?
Probably much the latter, although I would argue that incidents like those at Virginia Tech call forward everyone's attentiveness, social responsibility. And so I think we are at a heightened level in that regard. And I think it needs to remain that way.
I'm just curious. Are University of Illinois students permitted to have firearms in their dormitory rooms?
No. Let me be clear.
Okay. Well, I that would have been my assumption, but I don't know that I'd ever recalled having seen that discussed.
Yeah, well, it's actually, it varies state by state. I mean, you will find some other places where laws are less restrictive. Huh.
We'll try real quick to get in a caller here in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. I'd like to ask the chancellor about the university's considering enrolling more out-of-state students. That came up, I think, about 2 or 3 years ago as an issue, and I think there was an outcry against it in Illinois. But I just sometimes think the campus is really too Illinois inbred, if you know what I mean.
And I'll give you a minute.
Okay, so the motivation for that was, in fact, the cosmopolitan nature of the institution and how we educate our students. And to some extent, we do this through study abroad, through programs in Washington. So we are trying compensatory actions. But your point is well taken. You are right. There was an outcry. One of the advantages of a place like Michigan is that there's Michigan and Michigan State, and we don't seem to have that sister institution, which is quite the alternate as for as large a population as we might like.
We are going to have to stop, I'm sorry to say. We're here at the end of the time. I'm sure on another day, Chancellor Herman will come back. We'll do it again. Maybe in the fall we should do this one.
Let's plan on it. Right. Wonderful questioners.
Richard Herman, he's the Chancellor of the U of I here in Urbana-Champaign, has been since May of 2005. He's been here on the campus since 1998, also has served as Provost and Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs. Support for today's broadcast provided by World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods at 6th and University in Champaign. For over 15 years, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of name brand foods from around the world. Suggestions required. Quest always welcome. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio. Coming up a little bit later today as part of the afternoon magazine, Midwestern farmers markets are beginning to open. Did you know that these markets have had tremendous impact on the produce carried by supermarkets? When farmers markets boomed in the 90s, our spending on fruits and vegetables doubled, as did the number of produce items found in the grocery store. So much variety, and it's available every day of the year. But what about taste? What about flavor? Coming up today on the Afternoon Magazine, Celeste Quinn takes up those and other questions with food writer Russ Parsons, author of the book How to Pick a Peach, in the 1 o'clock hour. The show gets underway at noon. In our next hour, we'll be talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Jed Horn. He's metro editor of the Times-Picayune in New Orleans, and we'll talk about New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for telecommunication, thanks to the generosity of Allison Robert Campbell. We'll break for news and update on the markets. Stay tuned.
The Carle Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety, a division of Carle Foundation Hospital, is proud to underwrite agricultural programming at WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets, where at the Chicago Board of Trade, corn has rallied off its softer tone off the opening bell today and has showing positive gains at this hour. We'll begin in the July corn pit, where we see prices now at 366 and three quarters, up 3.5. July has been as low as 356 today. September, 371.5, up 3. December, 374.5, up 3.5. December 2008, 391.25, up 3 quarters. July beans, 770.